You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 12th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Welcome, teat suckers! You 300 million teat suckers, all expecting to get your Social Security checks. Well, we may have a surprise for you. We may have a little surprise. Suddenly, Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles' memo that they wrote, could it be the law of the land? Well, later in the program, we're going to introduce a feature where we will collect your cat food recipes. I don't know what we're going to do with them. Bind them in a book? Maybe I'll do a cooking show. It's good to get in early. If you can establish yourself as the guy, the go-to guy for all the best cat food recipes, it's quite possible I won't be doing the show much longer. I'll be on the Food Channel. I may have my own serious XM radio channel on just giving different cat food recipes. May be complicated. Next week is Passover, and I don't know if cat food is pesadilla for Passover. We'll have to check into that today on the program. Dahlia Lithwick, the senior editor from Slate, will be with us to talk about some recent Supreme Court rulings. And we'll be taking your phone calls later in the program at 646-259-3920. That's 646-257-3920. Let's get right into the news, ladies. Oh, I should also mention yesterday I was on Dylan Radigan's program, but it was sub-hosted by Matt Miller from whatever it is. Both Sides Are Equal from NPR. Or what is this show? Like, everybody's right, except for, but I'm more right. Adults Only. I can't remember what the name of the show is. But he was the host. I was on with Jonathan Alter and Tim Carney because... look, you know, when we're really talking serious stuff, it should be all men, right? I mean, we all ended up going to a Russian sweat spa afterwards and had ourselves fleeced with those branches. It was great. Not something you want to do, see any of those guys naked, frankly. But what are you going to do? You know, you pal around after the show. That's the way it works. No, actually, David Stockman was on. Had a very interesting exchange with him in the green room, and this guy's convinced the apocalypse, the financial apocalypse is upon us. I don't know. We'll talk about that later in the program. Speaking of apocalypse, Japanese authorities on Tuesday raised the severity rating of the nuclear crisis at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant to the highest level on an international scale, on par with the 1986 Chernobyl disaster. Now, despite the fact that they're doing this, there's still reports that it's sort of, things are getting slightly better. There was a fire yesterday, but it went out. Officials from Japan's nuclear agency reclassified the ongoing emergency from level 5, an accident with offsite risks, to level 7, a major accident. The reassessment comes at a time when the IAEA, this is the International Atomic Energy Agency, says the plant is showing, quote, early signs of recovery, but is still in critical condition. Radiation released from Fukushima amounted to one-tenth the total released from Chernobyl. There's still time, though, folks. TEPCO said that, quote, our concern is that the amount of leakage could eventually reach that of Chernobyl or exceed it. What are you going to do? At least it's going into the ocean where all the fish are. And it's not like the Japanese eat a lot of fish. On Monday, the Japanese government extended its 12-mile radius evacuation zone to 18 miles. U.S. Embassy still saying 50 miles. Fukushima is releasing 10,000 terabecquerels of radioactivity per hour. I don't know what that means, but it seems like a lot. It seems like a lot. Most radiation readings around Fukushima, however, have been decreasing for several weeks, but the plant faces constant threat of aftershocks. On Tuesday, a 6.2 magnitude trembler. I don't know. Maybe we'll hear back from our peeps in Japan. Send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Give me a sense of what's going on over there. You know, in the United States, basically, the only thing that we talk about is the Fukushima. There, as far as anybody in this country is concerned, there was no tsunami, no earthquake. Everybody's fine. It's not a big deal. Whatever. That's just the way it works. Meanwhile, Wall Street Journal reports that the president is open to a deal on the debt ceiling vote, which is going to have to take place soon. People are looking at this piece in the Wall Street Journal a little bit askance, askew, as it were, because it really doesn't provide any new information. So hard to say, but, you know, with Obama, it certainly would fit his M.O., to negotiate on something where he needs to absolutely, absolutely not negotiate anything. Nate Silver has a piece on the dangers that exist for John Boehner basically playing chicken with the debt ceiling. New York Times reports the Republican leader, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. Now, supposedly he visited the White House yesterday, McConnell, and it was supposed to be hush-hush, but apparently, it's pretty difficult if you are the Senate Minority Leader to sneak into the White House without anybody knowing. McConnell has privately urged the conservatives not to filibuster. See, here's the game that the Republicans are going to play. You know, guys like Rand Paul?
You are a douchebag.
Oh, that's one way of pronouncing it. And Rand Paul, you know, I'm going to vote against the debt ceiling. But, of course, don't worry, it's going to go up anyways. But I'm going to show that I have the balls to vote against something I know is actually not going to happen. And so the Republicans, they don't want to vote for raising the debt ceiling because they got so tired of pushing that yes button seven times during the Bush administration that they now have carpal tunnel syndrome. Or just cowardice. And so what McConnell has privately urged conservatives to do is to not filibuster it so that a vote can be taken. The Democrats will be forced to vote for it. The Republicans can pretend like they weren't for raising the debt ceiling, even though all their taskmasters, the bond vigilantes, the members of Wall Street, the Koch brothers, all of their favorite friends know that it would be problematic not to vote for this debt ceiling, raising it. So the Republicans could try and force all the votes to come from the 51 Democrats, including the 17 who are up for re-election. This is the game they're going to play. Force them to vote to raise the debt ceiling, then we will campaign against them. So please do not filibuster it. Because if you filibuster it, then we can't force them to take the vote and take all the blame because we know that they're the adults, except for when they're not. So if 60 votes are required because of the filibuster, ultimately some Republicans would have to vote for the increase, lest the party be blamed for the debt crisis. That's the game here. And Matt Iglesias has a very good suggestion from Barack Obama. It's a two-pronged strategy, he writes. The first one is a credible, repeated commitment not to surrender anything in exchange for getting Congress to agree that the debt ceiling be increased. So first, Obama has to come out and be forceful.
I don't think so.
Then the second prong is to move on to thinking about what happens when we reach the debt ceiling. It's not a sudden shutdown, writes Iglesias. The Treasury can still operate using the funds that come in from taxes. But for a while, the people administrating the federal government will be able to selectively stiff people, that being Obama and Geithner. So the right strategy is to start stiffing people Republicans care about. When bills to defense contractors come due, don't pay them. Explain they'll get 100% of what they're owed when the debt ceiling is raised. Don't make some farm payments. Stop sending Medicare reimbursements. Make doctors and hospitals, the farmers and defense contractors, and the currently elderly bear the inconvenience for a few weeks of uncertain payment schedules. See how you like that. Will it happen? I doubt it. Perfect opportunity for Obama. Let's see if he takes it. Doubt it. Later in the program, we'll talk about the budget deal. But this is just too funny to not share with you right now. You know how many times you hear, you watch these campaign ads, and then they play some song that you really like, and you think, oh, my God, that's so horrible. That's so horrible that, you know, I think it was Bush was playing Born in the USA. And you're like, he doesn't even get what that song's about. He doesn't even get what the song is about. How can this happen? Well, it turns out it's not supposed to happen. And Charlie Crist, when he was running for senator in Florida, he played Talking Head song, Road to Nowhere. And apparently, David Byrne, he guessed it on Majority Report 1. He didn't appreciate it, and he's got deep pockets. And so he sued Charlie Crist, and apparently they settled. And no one's quite sure what's part of the settlement, but we do know there's one part. Charlie Crist had to make a YouTube, and here it is.
Hi, I'm Charlie Crist. During 2010, I ran for a seat in the United States Senate. During that campaign, a video advertisement utilized a song made famous by David Byrne and the Talking Heads called Road to Nowhere. The advertisement was posted on my campaign website, on YouTube, and sent out via email. Regrettably, the campaign did not ask permission to obtain a license from Mr. Byrne to use Road to Nowhere in the advertisement. In fact, Mr. Byrne has never permitted his songs to be used for advertising of any kind, a position I respect deeply. The use of David Byrne's song and his voice in my campaign advertisement without his permission was wrong and should not have occurred. I do not support, nor do I condone, any actions taken by anyone involved in the Senate campaign that were inconsistent with David Byrne's rights, or with any other artist's rights, or the various legal protections afforded to intellectual property. I sincerely apologize to David Byrne for using his famous song and his unique voice in my campaign advertisement without his permission. I pledge that, should there be any future election campaigns for me, I will respect and uphold the rights of artists and obtain permission or a license for the use of any copyrighted work. Thank you.
And I cannot wait to see the YouTube video Charlie Crist puts out with him walking across a kitchen floor and having to drink out of the little kitty's milk bowl. Apparently somebody didn't want to pay the $1 million or that David Byrne wanted to do. So we're going to take a break. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will be talking to Dahlia Lithwick, senior Slate editor. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about the budget deal, this conversation I had with David Stockman about his apocalyptic visions of what's happening in the bond market. I'll give you another, some information out of Wisconsin on this county clerk. Apparently she's had some real dubious elections in her county over the years. Something like 97% of her county one year turned out to vote. That's higher than most countries that have mandatory voting. Very interesting. All right, folks, we'll be right back after this brief message. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to this edition of the Majority Report Senior Slate Editor Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dahlia, let's go over. There's been some court cases over the past, I guess, couple of weeks, and Supreme Court cases that I want to touch on. You know, the Supreme Court is quickly becoming the sole reason why I can come up with to support Barack Obama in 2012, frankly. and I'm not even convinced if that's going to hold out long term, but who knows. But so let's touch on this stuff here. Let's start with the decision a couple of weeks ago by the Obama administration, not really having anything to do with the Supreme Court at this point, but and it really shouldn't be the Obama administration. We should be talking about only the Department of Justice to make the decision not to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his co-defendants, these 9/11 plotters, in a civilian court. You had a very strongly worded piece about this.
Right. I think that this was something that was a long time in the making, Sam. In other words, it began when Obama campaigned on things like closing Guantanamo, when the administration, and you're right, it was Eric Holder, announced that they were going to try KSM and his confederates in a civilian trial in an Article III court in New York City. I think they had no expectation that the blowback was going to be what it was. I mean, I think partly this is their fault for not laying the groundwork when you have New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Chuck Schumer turn around and say, oh, my God, we can't have a trial in New York. It suggests to me that they just didn't do the reconnaissance and the handshaking in advance. But for months and months and months thereafter, we saw both rhetorically, you know, with all the speechifying about how this couldn't happen and state secrets would be revealed and it would be a danger and it would cost bajillions of dollars to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in open court. We saw what ramped up finally to be legislation that made it impossible. I mean, literally impossible to bring folks from Guantanamo to the United States for a trial. So basically, when Holder made his announcement that last week that they would have to try him in a military tribunal at Guantanamo, that was really just ratifying what he says was having his hands tied by the Congress. But quite right to say that this was something that the Obama administration staked their reputation on. Holder said, this is the one thing I want to be judged on, is my ability to have a fair trial, an open trial, and they caved on that.
Well, first off, now everybody knows that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has radioactive vision and would blow a hole through any type of civilian court, right? And then he would just escape. Is that what the fear was?
You know, it's the great lie surrounding the KSM trial is that we have never done this before. You know, that we haven't tried hundreds of terrorists in civilian courts, that they're not incarcerated in jails, that somehow not only do they have heat vision, but when you put them in jail in the United States, somehow Lex Luthor come and rescues them and the
right.
Batcopter. So all of these are just systemic lies that you can't have fair trials. And I think one of the things that Holder tried to say over and over again is, look at the evidence. We had the first World Trade Center bomber was put on trial. Look at the evidence. We've incarcerated so many of them. Look at the evidence. There is no reason to believe that things that are said at trial imperil U.S. security. But it just didn't matter. At that point, you know, the horse was out of the barn. Public opinion was what it was. And all of this would be a sort of interesting academic question were it not for the fact that we are setting precedent here. We are now announcing as a policy matter that some people are too dangerous to be tried in open courts, that the U.S. justice system is inadequate for some classes of criminals. We've never believed that. We've never taken that position. And the idea that some criminals might not be prosecuted and detained and executed is not a reason to not try them.
It's so Constitution light, right? I mean, it's the Constitution light. It's so you can actually fit it in your back pocket. It's easier that way if you take out some of those, you know, sort of civil rights that we have, that we sort of espouse.
Well, that was, you know, the great invention of the Bush administration was that we have one set of law for good and one set of law for medium. You know, we have one setting that's for people that, not only terrorists, but people who might be terrorists or people who might talk on the phone with terrorists, you know, all of their rights evaporate. And by suggesting that they're going to continue those policies in 100 different ways, from everything from invoking the state secrets doctrine in trials to continuing FISA, to everything the Obama administration has done to suggest that we have laws that are for good people and then laws that are for people we're very nervous about is just so antithetical to what the Constitution promises. And it's really dispiriting, Sam, to see it trotted out by the Obama administration that campaigned against this kind of principle.
There's two things that strike me. First off, wasn't the sort of the original sin by the Obama administration was not to immediately close down this whole notion of military tribunals? Because, I mean, it would have put more pressure on Congress if they didn't exist anymore, it seems to me. And then the second question I have for you, isn't it possible that the Obama administration could simply fly in one of these Article III judges? Article III judges are basically federal judges that don't have specific jurisdictions. Couldn't they take one of these, fly one of these guys into Guantanamo and actually hold the case there?
That was a suggestion that was made months and months ago by several people. Just if you can't try folks stateside, have an open civilian trial at Guantanamo. And so I see no problem with doing that. The suggestion that their hands are tied, I don't see why that is the case. But I think to your first point, I don't know, quite frankly, what the Obama administration could have done different. I think they inherited a situation at Guantanamo that is so politically toxic. And what's problematic from your and my perspective is that it's not just toxic because, you know, Democrats as well as Republicans voted not to allow folks to come here to be tried. So this is just horrible, horrible political football that no one wants to touch. When you've got Schumer and you've got Bloomberg saying, ugh, you know, don't bring them here. We don't want to even incarcerate them here. You've got a bipartisan problem. But I think the larger problem, the larger sin is failing to acknowledge what the rest of the world thinks of these moments, how Guantanamo has really tarnished the United States in the eyes of the world, what it means to tell the world that American court system are only for certain people but not for your people. That's the real fear, and it seems to me that's the sin that cannot be cured. Rick Hertzberg has a great piece in The New Yorker this week saying, what is it that we're telling the world? And by failing to look at our own errors in the past, Bush administration as well as Obama errors, by pretending we can just move forward, wipe the slate clean, and have these pretty little trials down there, we're really not acknowledging what we've done to the world and in the eyes of the world, the greatness, the enormity of the sin that we have committed.
Dahlia, put your I guess, I don't know if you have one, but a political psychoanalytical hat on. I mean, of all the things that the Obama administration has executed, has planned, I mean, of all the things that the Obama administration has done that I have disagreed with, this type of stuff is the most sort of, I have the hardest time reconciling this. Because here's a guy who was a constitutional, he is maligned as being too professorial. He's maligned as being a constitutional law professor. But this is the last thing one would ever expect from someone like this.
My psychoanalytic skills are really limited, Sam, so I want to caveat what I say.
I think two
things are, I suspect, happening. One is, I think Obama took office and immediately signed, you know, an order saying we're closing Gitmo. And then I think you start getting the morning security briefings. And I do think that those briefings would probably scare anyone's pants off. And I think the responsibility of keeping this country safe and the implication that even when you get the guy, right, even when you get the Christmas bomber and the systems perform as they ought to have, you're still maligned and blamed for somehow doing it wrong. I think there's no space here. When he catches terrorists, he loses. When he doesn't catch terrorists, he loses. And I think the rhetoric is such that all he's been able to do is be on defense and say, we can't have a single mistake, a single error. If even one person leaves Guantanamo and rejoins the battle against us, then the entire administration will be judged for that. So I think there's some sense there that there's no space to air, and it makes them really cautious. I think the other problem that I'm seeing is that Obama, while he was a constitutional law professor, he cares deeply about the Constitution. I think in the end is much more results-oriented and ends-oriented than we wanted to believe, and I think that there is some feeling that if we can just clear these folks out of Gitmo, start anew, turn our faces forward, no truth commission, no looking backward, no prosecutions for Bush administration officials, somehow a new day will dawn and we'll all be okay for it. And I think that the law is a long and slow process, and the failure to understand that there are consequences, there needs to be accountability. We need to be able to own our mistakes. That seems to be the failure here. And I think that being results-oriented and ends-oriented about the law is always a mistake.
Is that what the message he's sending to in terms of Bradley Manning? I mean, because we have a guy who is, we have now 250 law professors writing a letter, including Lawrence Tribe, who was a supporter of Obama's. I think he's probably lost his opportunity to get appointed to the Supreme Court, has talked about the shameless treatment of this guy, and there is no security issues involved. They're making this is like sort of like a this is like putting the guy in the stockades in the middle of the public square.
That's right, and the letter is so compelling. It essentially says this: there's no security reason for doing this. This is a way to telegraph to whistleblowers what the consequences will be and how dangerous it is that we're going to treat whistleblowers this way. And I think you're quite right. For someone like Professor Tribe, who literally wrote the book on constitutional law, is seen as this iconic figure in American constitutional law and was Obama's mentor and hero, for him to turn around and call out the president and say, this is verging on torture, this is verging on unconstitutional abuse, it is very, very profound. And I think my answer as to how this can be happening is the same as my answer before. I think this is just we're trying to achieve certain ends here. We're not looking at the big sweep of the law. We're not looking at the big implications. We have started down a road in this country of differentiating certain accused from other accused, some defendants from other defendants, having two tiers of law. And it is always going to be convenient if you have two tiers of law to treat people badly. That is the principle the Constitution is supposed to prevent.
All right. Well, let's move on to some actual court cases. There's been a couple that show really the implications of this 4-5 split, and it's becoming clearer at least where Kennedy stands more often than not on he being the sort of the fulcrum of the court, I guess. Let's talk about this McComish-Bennett case. It hasn't been decided yet. Is that correct? It's still but they just had oral arguments.
That's correct. They only just heard oral argument 2 weeks ago, and this is the first big campaign finance case to come before the court after Citizens United. And Citizens United, famously the Bush v. Gore of this Roberts court, determined that corporations had the same interest in free speech as individuals, and really, I think, unleashed, not only struck down provisions of McCain-Feingold, but also unleashed massive corporate spending, anonymous corporate spending on the rest of us. So this was the first time that the court was examining the campaign finance issue and the free speech issue since then, and it pretty much was a do-over that case of Citizens United. We didn't see much different. It was a narrower question. The question involved an Arizona Clean Elections Act, which was passed by voter initiative in 1998. And all it said was, if you take public financing, you have the possibility of getting funds if the folks who took private financing outspend you by certain amounts. Now, that's capped at 3 times the original grant. But the idea was to kind of level the playing field, so if you choose to take public financing as a candidate, they can't just outspend you with impunity. And this was challenged by the folks who took private financing, who said, no, this implicates my speech rights, because if I'm paying for an ad for myself, I'm also, by implication, paying for the other guy, for my opponent, and that forces me to spend my money on his behalf. And the court was completely sympathetic to that. By the same 5-4 margin we saw in Citizens United, we saw the court saying, you can't tinker with the election system to force people who don't accept public financing to subsidize the speech of others. That's shocking and unconscionable.
No, but they're not really subsidizing the speech. They're triggering, right? I mean, because what they're saying is that they, if I spend $3, the Arizona will give you $1. And because of that, because once I cross that threshold of spending $3, I'm actually diminishing the amount of speech I have because your speech is cutting into my speech. Is that the argument?
Well, you're channeling Elena Kagan. Both the two new justices, Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor at argument, just kept being confounded by where the speech claim is here. Where is the speech claim? How is it possible? Nobody, guy who takes private financing, is restricting your speech. You can speak as much as you want. You can pour billions and billions of dollars into your ads, but understand your opponent is going to get some capped amount of money to respond. This is not an infringement of speech, but in the court's view, or at least the majority of the court's view, is very much an infringement of speech. Justice Kennedy, you know, everybody watches, as you suggested, everybody watches Justice Kennedy to see where he's going to come out. This was one of those cases where it was very clear where he was going to come out. He said at oral argument, don't you think it's a fair characterization of this law to say that its whole purpose and effect are to produce less speech in a political campaign? So he sees this as a law that, instead of creating a clean election, suppresses speech. And I think once you have 5 votes for that, it doesn't matter that there's no speech implicated. You have 5 votes for it.
Let me howl at the moon for a moment. And maybe, you know, I left law school after the first year, and maybe they covered this in years 2 and 3. But if they are accepting that notion that speech is relative, that in some way, because either I am I have less of incentive to spend $3 because your $1 kicks in, Or because I spent $3, you have $1, and then I'm left with basically $2 worth of speech. If they are accepting this premise that speech is can be abridged relative to other people's speech, doesn't that basically say that there is a problem with corporate money in the first place? Because that's the argument that we would make, isn't it? That the enormous amount of money, i.e. speech, is actually abridging our speech because it's drowning out everything else.
Well, I think that the problem they would have with your analogy, I don't disagree. I think the problem is if you watched argument in Citizens United or if you read the opinions, they're not talking about the Leviathan, Exxon, Walmart, Target free speech. Justice Scalia is so careful to constantly rephrase this in terms of the mom and pop, you know, grocery store down the corner and the barber shop on the corner, you know. That's the corporate speech that's being infringed, and that most corporations are just some nice guy who wanted to cut hair and he incorporated. And so I think one of the fictions at the heart of Citizens United is that these things aren't controlled by a handful of entities that really, really massively influence campaigns from outside, that it's controlled, it's a way of letting everybody participate in the democracy. And, you know, you're quite right, that's a fiction, but it's a fiction the court really loves. The other fiction that is so funny that carried over from Citizens United to McComish is the idea that this was a law that was passed by incumbents to protect themselves. And this is one of Justice Scalia, Antonin Scalia's bugaboos. He always says, oh, well, of course these campaign finance rules benefit incumbents, and so of course they're going to keep passing them even if they're unconstitutional. But this was a ballot initiative. Right. It was passed by the voters in Arizona in the wake of a whole bunch of shocking financial scandals around elections. So the idea that this was just to be dismissed because, oh, incumbents in Arizona are protecting their interests is completely false.
All right. Well, Dahlia, I guess maybe I'll have to recontemplate going back to law school, see if I can get into the game a little bit. It's just too frustrating.
It's very frustrating.
All right. Well, we will talk again. I've held you far longer than I know you're a very busy person, but we have to take a break. And we'll have you back again soon, Dahlia. And thank you. I want to focusing on the court. I think it's, you know, sort of one of the last vestiges of hope that we have in this country, and right now it doesn't look terribly hopeful.
I think it's slightly more hopeful than you think, and I would just suggest be very glad that Elena Kagan finished law school, because she, I think, is having a really interesting effect on the court case.
All right, well, we'll have you back to talk about that, because I'd love to hear more about that. Dahlia Lithwick, Senior Slate Editor, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
All right, folks, we got to take a break, and we'll come back. Just want to touch on this budget stuff and give you a little house cleaning. Let you know what's going to happen over the next week and a half. It's going to be great. All right, we'll be right back after this. Folks, we're back. I'm going to go a little long today. Just some house cleaning. Tomorrow I will be traveling. So we will have an interview that I did with Ari Berman about Jim Messina, who's been named to head Obama's 2012 campaign. And Thursday and Friday, knock on wood, I will be broadcasting live from Las Vegas. Should have some fun. Cliff Schechter will be around. I'll be talking to some plaintiff litigators, or trial lawyers, as I like to call them, who are going to be talking about some financial cases, other cases that, you know, again, I've said it many times, trial lawyers, there's a reason why they're demonized. It is because they are the last vestige that we have after regulatory creep. And I will hopefully be broadcasting live from a couple of blackjack tables. Nikki has allowed me $15 to gamble with. So I will be looking for the quarter minimum blackjack table.
And you're going to come back with our salaries for the next month.
That's right. That's what I told her. I said, sweetie, give me, let me go with $300. I will turn it into 10 grand. We won't even we both get gym memberships. Not quite. But it should be fun. And I'm going to hopefully do a pre-tape with Chris Rosen, because I am going to just, God, I can't tell you. I get more emails about Chris Rosen than anything else on this program. Also, over the next couple of days, I may shoot a pilot. Let's play this number four. Not quite sure what I'm going to call it yet, but it's, we're going to play it now. Here we go. A little bit louder. I don't know if this is going to be the theme music. I'm just going to wait for it to kick in. That's right. It's going to be Cat Food Cooking with Sam. We're going to present. That's it? That's the whole song?
Yeah, that's
it. Are you shitting me?
No.
Jesus.
Took us a while to find that, too.
Yeah, I guess so. not quite long enough for an intro. Maybe I'll shoot a video where I do, where I cook. You got to send me in your best cat food recipes in anticipation of the memo written by Erskine Bowles and former Senator, what is it? Humbugs Simpson. I can't even remember his first name now. Because it looks like Obama may be adopting that. One of the staples of that is cutting Social Security by raising the retirement age. Because, look, come on. People are living so much longer now if you are rich. If you are rich, you are living longer. Listen, and people talk about means testing on Social Security. You should also know that if you were to means test Social Security, you know what the savings would be? Virtually nothing. You'd save a little bit, but nothing. The cuts proposed in the Erskine Bowles, what is it, the Homer Simpson program plan, which was supposed to be the Deficit Commission report, but of course they couldn't even get anybody to agree on it. So it's not a Deficit Commission report. You'll see it written up as a Deficit Commission report. It's not. To the extent that those words, Deficit Commission report, mean anything, it is not that. It is a memo put out by Erskine Bowles and Thurston Simpson, or whatever his name is. And both foes of Social Security, and you're all teat suckers. 300 million of you teat suckers. So just on this budget deal that passed the other day, just to give you an update, what's in there, funding for federal Pell Grants, job training, children's health care initiative, steep cuts. What are you going to do? F you, college students. F you, people who have been out of work. And F you, children. I can't get health care. Shut up. Go get a job. Bill contains some policy provisions, including language preventing Guantanamo Bay detainees from being transferred to the United States for any purpose, because we know how much that's going to save on the deficit. It eliminates funding for four Obama administration SARs, because we know how many, each one of them gets paid $1 billion. And why are we using the word czar? This is America, not communist China. Or whatever Glenn Beck would say about it. They terminated 55 programs in the areas of health, labor, and education, resulting for a total savings of more than $1 billion. Wow. Almost one-sixth of what Bill Gates has. And, of course, they cut back to the United Nations and international organizations. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, they cut a $1.6 billion cut from the EPA. They cut from the Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife Services. Well, I mean, fortunately, the pollutants that will be put into the rivers and lakes and streams by the cuts in the EPA will kill all the fish anyways, and so there's some savings right off the bat. National Park Service, $127 million cut, which is fine because, you know, you could watch it on TV. Clean and Drinking Water State Revolving Funds, whatever, almost $1 billion cut. I mean, look, seriously, folks, if we just make one compromise, let's pollute all our streams, rivers, and lakes, the savings would be awesome. You don't have to worry about protecting fish anymore. Just like flora and fauna will die. Less money to... What are you going to do? So I go on Radigan yesterday. And, you know, David Stockman, former budget director for the Reagan administration... He's talking to me in the green room. He's not talking to me. He's talking to Jonathan Alter, but I just sat right there, pretended like I was looking at my my iPhone. I mean, he was sort of, I mean, I introduced myself, but I was pretending like I wasn't listening because, you know, I'm like at the kids table. Jonathan Alter was nice. We didn't get into an argument this time. He's a perfectly nice guy, and he didn't say anything that, you know, how old are you? But Stockman was there, and Stockman was saying, like, these Republicans, they're like they have a religious fervor about tax cutting. They have no idea what's going on. It's a joke. They're a joke. And he said some of this on the show, too, so, and I'm sure he would have said more. He's saying it all publicly. But he's like, PIMCO is shorting Treasury bonds. And this is it, man. This is it. He's talking months. Now, what happens, and so I said, well, so they're shorting Treasury bonds, but where are they going to put their money? Well, commodities and this and that. We're going to get inflation, and the Fed after the QE2, this is the quantitative easing. You know, because the Fed's been buying up some of these Treasury bonds, essentially. What they do is they lend money at a very low rate, and then people turn around, they buy Treasury bonds with it. That's the way they make money. It's the easiest scam in the world. And essentially what's going on is the Fed is buying Treasury bonds to maintain their value, which also means that lower interest rates on these things. So he says they're going to stop, which I don't believe that they're going to stop. They're going to keep doing it in one form or another. They'll find some way, whether they announce it publicly or not. And he says, and then nobody's going to buy the Treasury. You know, nobody's going to buy the Treasury bonds. But I said, well, where are people going to park their money where they know they can get it can be safe? And he goes, well, commodities, they'll get into more speculative things. And then I said, well, but I don't understand what the problem is. Well, to sell Treasury bonds, they're going to have to increase rates, interest rates, and then we're going to get massive inflation. Now, here's the question I didn't get to ask him on Radigan, because by the time it got to me, it was like I first started with what's more important, jobs or this? And he's like, this! The dirty little secret they don't tell you about is that inflation is not bad for most of us. Obviously, 10, 12% inflation, bad. But we're already seeing the two things that most people pay for inflated, food and fuel. And so if you get inflation on other assets, what you're going to start to see is that it's going to be, you're going to get more money to save. Your mortgage payments are going to be easier to make. Inflation hurts lenders. Who are lenders? They are the banks. They are bondholders. Even though in its instance they're borrowing money from the U.S. government, the value of their bonds as they trade them goes down because the interest rates go up on them. And they're out loaning money all over the place. Because a lot of those institutional bondholders tend to be banks. So this is really more of protect the wealthy's money. And not only is that the dynamic, there is no evidence that PIMCO shorting bonds, because they anticipate inflation going up a little bit, but if they make 1 or 2 percentage points on this stuff, it's definitely worth it. So Washington Post reports there's one surprising group of people who's not terribly worried about the budget brinksmanship in Washington. Investors who lend the U.S. government billions of dollars. Now, according to Stockman, when inflation goes rampant, people are going to divest themselves of the dollars. And I'm like, well, what are they going to put their money into? Gold? You know, these major institutional investors, they don't buy reams and reams, or I don't know what, blocks and blocks of gold. The only other choice they have is to go into another currency. What currency are they going to go into? What currency? Yuan? They're not going to be able to do that overnight. They're not going to get the rest of the world to spend money in yuans. The euro? Are you kidding me? So all of this is really just about protecting the wealthy. Just keep that in mind. When you hear all this screaming about the debt and the deficit, it's the fear is that it's going to diminish the value of money for people who have a lot of money. Most people in this country, the vast majority of people, do not have money. It's not going to lose value because they don't have it. That's what they're doing. In the meantime, there's not even any indication that this PIMCO thing has anything to do with it. The U.S. government was able to borrow money for the decade at 3.5% on Monday. That's a 10-year treasury bond, up from 3.4% a week earlier, but below February levels. In other words, there's no run. There's no running away from treasury. They don't have to raise the interest rates enormously to attract these loans. PIMCO, the largest bond investor, disclosed over the weekend that its $236 billion total return fund now holds negative 3% of its assets in treasuries, meaning it would actually make money if treasury bonds decline in value. They decline in value, they raise their interest rates. Unless entitlements are not substantially reformed, the U.S. will likely default on its debt, Gross said in an April report. Not in conventional ways, but via inflation, currency devaluation, and low to negative real interest rates. In other words, well, it's not going to default the way that Glenn Beck tells you it will, and you'll have to use heritage seeds and freeze-dried food and gold bullion and trade with your neighbor. You know, I've got some gas for that cow. No, what he's saying is, but via inflation. In other words, there's going to be less value in those loans that you've made. Currency is going to be devalued. Yeah, that means that it's going to be more work for Americans as they export stuff to other countries because their exports are going to be cheaper. Low to negative real interest rates. In other words, you're going to lose value on your loans. The bottom line is, folks, this is rich people screaming about the chance that they may lose some of their capital and trying to make it seem like it's everybody's problem. Prices in the bond markets, the low levels of return that investors are willing to accept, suggest that investors broadly are not buying Gross's thesis for now. And finally, let me end with this. Ezra Klein has a post up showing a graph from the Congressional Budget Office in September showing that if we do nothing about the deficit and the debt, the budget comes into roughly into balance over the course of the next 70 years. In other words, in about 70 years, we can start to run surpluses. The nothing in this instance means you need to do three things. One, all the Bush tax cuts expire as they're currently scheduled to do. In other words, go back to pre-Bush taxation levels. Frankly, I think we should go further than that, but be that as it may. The Medicare doc fix is either implemented or its repeal is paid for over the next 70 years. In other words, the $300 billion that doctors are not receiving for their payments from Medicare, fix that so they don't have to push inefficiently push those expenses onto the rest of us. and the Affordable Care Act is implemented and all of its spending targets are met and all of its taxes collected. That's it, folks. You can do nothing. But instead, we're going to see this as an ideological way to cut things like Social Security, things they've been wanting to do forever. Forever. All right, folks. You want to IM me at Majority FM? Do so. You want to call me at 646-257-3920? That's 646-257-3920. Tomorrow will be a pre-tape show, but it's all new to you. And then I'll be back live from Vegas. And then there'll be a week worth of interviews while I take my first vacation in 7 months, which won't be a vacation. You know I'll be doing stuff. But we just do that. That daily 24-hour clock will be happening. Folks, please, there are thousands, literally thousands upon thousands of you who aren't members, and I know at least 10 of you can be. In fact, I know probably I would say 80% of you can be. You listen to the show once a week, twice a week, three times a week. Some of you listen on a daily basis. You don't have, think of all the blogs, the news you don't have to read. I just give it to you in tight chunks. Become a member. Please. And don't forget to use that Amazon link and buy some coffee at justcoffee.co-op. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. We'll be right back after this with the post show.